That's right, it fillets and chops, dice and slices, never stops. Lasts a lifetime, mows your lawn. And it mows your lawn and it picks up the kids from school. It gets rid of unwanted facial hair. It gets rid of embarrassing age spots. It delivers a pizza.
All right, here we are. Sponsored by nobody. But wait, we're sponsored by somebody, listeners. This is part three, and as you're well aware, that somebody is End Transmission Games. I have another special guest for you tonight, Devin Oratz, the, shall we say, most important or most important and a half person at End Transmission.
Our consultant, Ron Edwards, who's kind of a big deal, would like this. I refer to myself as one of the creator, owner, publishers of End Transmission Games.
A man of many hats, and all of those hats happen to be a crown, it would seem.
Oh, that's so sweet. That's so sweet of you.
So, here we are.
And missing is my co-creator, co-owner, co-publisher, Michaela Bree.
Yes, unfortunately, Michaela could not make it. That is a shame. We were hoping to get a bit more in-depth work on layout and just, you know, how it is from her perspective running the company, but... What can we do, right? You guys are
very
busy.
She might be relaxing for the first 2 hours in the last 200, so she needs that.
Exactly. Listeners, you may not be aware, but right now we're the day of the Kickstarter launch. You will only hear this
yes.
a week later, maybe a week in a few days, so very big things are happening. And I think we can launch on in with that. So, Systems Malfunction, the Kickstarter, it's beginning today. What's happening?
It is. And it's our third Kickstarter, the first being Psyonix, and the second being Splinter Surprising Things, where we actually managed, with help from a good friend, to kickstart a couple of source books for a game that not a ton of people had heard. So that was awesome. But this is our third Kickstarter, and it is by far the first one that feels like it's for reals, and it is for Systems Malfunction, which is a standalone science fiction role-playing.
Now, listeners have already heard the intro adventure, The Fall of Union Vale, but let's talk a bit about Systems Malfunction. Tell us a bit about the game, about the setting. Tell us about the world that we'll be kickstarting in this coming week.
Sure. So Earth was doomed, more or less, by an extinction. So there was a lottery, which was, of course, completely rigged by corporate interests and special... interest groups and the ultra wealthy for seats, about 100 million of them, on an escape vehicle called the Iron Gaia. And the problem is that so basically they should have structured it as a generation chip. You know what a generation chip is?
Exactly. Good old hard sci-fi generation chips. Throw a population on, you let them live it out, and by the time they get to their destination, you have 10 or 50 generations down the line ready to go.
Exactly, but the problem is that they didn't do it that way because they thought it was inhumane, basically, to keep people awake in skeleton crews on this cold, cold ship on this journey which might take thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years.
I'm sure the people, wanting to get aboard and buying their tickets to get aboard on the black market also, you know, wanted to go to bed on Earth and wake up on New Planet, not live in a ship the rest of their damn lives.
So, mommy's gonna watch everyone while they sleep. And that's straight out of Pink Floyd. But mommy is gonna watch everyone while they sleep, and mommy is the Gaia. And as per AIs are a crapshoot, the Gaia experiences some mental issues, and as a result, mankind is changed forever.
Alright, how has mankind changed? What happens aboard the Iron Gaia?
Oh boy, three major things which provide you with your three playable origins in the game. So the first thing is that the Gaia decides to kidnap a bunch of psychic aliens for reasons that really make sense only to her. And she stores them amidst the cryogenically frozen humans trapped in the prison of sleep. The Gaia gets hit by something like a meteor or a comet, which really fucks her shit up, and a bunch of humans wake up. A lot of them probably are told to go back to sleep, and like good little sheeple, they fly and they go back to sleep. But the rest of them try to offer some resistance, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the Gaia builds basically Terminators that look like people on the outside. But on the inside, they can be anything from killer endoskeletons to straight-up bombs. And she uses those to start mopping up the resistance. But those are just kind of the last two things I mentioned, the replicants and the Zell, are kind of just side effects. What the Gaia was really trying to do was to create post-humanity. And that is the Celestial. So in Systems Malfunction, you can play as your character origin a human, a replicant, who have since been reverse engineered by humans to do more diverse things than hunting down and killing humans. although by all means, they can still do that. A Zell alien kidnapped and dumped in a totally unfamiliar culture you're forced to assimilate into. With otherness, there's nothing you can do about. Or one of the immortal post-humans created by the Gaia, which everyone hates and fears for what are really eminently reasonable reasons.
Yes. I think you can kind of pick up on that from the amount of fear that seems to be based around the Gaia and what it stood for before humanity broke free of it. Anything related to it is probably going to be hunted.
And her death is definitely, since this is probably only going out to a few hundred listeners, like her death is, it's definitely a comic book death. It's not an on-screen death. The other problem is that at the moment of her death, there were four of her, not just one.
So yeah, the death of the Iron Gaia. So after she failed and went silent, humanity took control of the generation ship.
So basically, she got murdered by this guy, Armand Carter. Who became known as the greatest hero of humanity because he basically saved humanity from an insane AI that was totally, to use technical terms, shitting it the fuck up. He punched the Gaia right in the neural matrix, and the entire station crash-landed at that very moment on a suspiciously Earth-like planet. Then they had to leave that planet because it exploded too. For reasons that no one remembers or wrote down. Anyway, fast forward 500 years, and the Confederated Colonial Republics control a little under 100 planets, and they are ruled by the descendants of Armand Carter.
Mm-hmm. Now, as a little spoiler for the listeners, Armand Carter has his bones in the original RPG Maker game you created with the Systems Malfunction setting, doesn't he?
He does.
Just a little bit of trivia for the listeners.
He does, and he's also on one of our best pieces of promotional art, which is on the Kickstarter, which goes live in an hour and a half.
Good lord!
In exactly 90 minutes from my local time.
Yeah, 90 minutes. There we go. Okay, so humanity, the empire, the world of Systems Malfunction now in the present,
It likes to call itself a confederation, but it's ruled by a democratically elected president for life.
Perfect. That makes so much sense, right?
Whose last name is always Carter, by coincidence, because that's who the people vote for.
I mean, stick with the name you can trust.
He beat the Gaia.
It's like that joke about Jesus said he'd get rid of all sin, and you know Odin and Thor said they'd get rid of the frost giants. You don't see any more frost giants around, do you?
But there are still Celestials, and you can be one.
Mm-hmm. So, what does modern Systems Malfunction, the setting, look for the players? What's the landscape for them? What can they play? What kind of adventures can they engage in?
So this is a chapter that I'm really looking forward to writing soon, because I love actually designing games, as opposed to waging 90 days of prep for Kickstarter campaigns to fund games. A chapter I'm really looking forward to writing is a chapter describing the basic three modes of play Systems Malfunction 2 fall into. And those are basically... you are somewhere civilized, so try not to break the law too overtly, is how I'd informally describe one of them. I'd informally describe the other mode of play as you are trapped in a cyber dungeon. Good luck not dying as you try to meet that cyber dungeon's maker, which has many fine examples in the future history of systems malfunction. And the third mode of play as a group of very, very different individuals trying to build a community on the frontier.
All right. So, tell us a bit about the character options available. You said there were Replicants, Celestials, Zell, and Humans, correct?
Celestials, Zell, and Humans. Yes, Celestials come in four color-coded choirs that are also conveniently named alphabetically by the kind of Celestial they are. Alpha, Delta, Sigma, and Omega Celestials have all been genetically engineered to perfection, mechanically enhanced to perfection in ways more subtle than any existing human tech, and then given completely unique nano-augmentation by the Gaia. When the Gaia was defeated, let's say euphemistically, by Armand Carter, the Celestials were basically left adrift and abandoned. Mommy was gone, and they were in a galaxy full of people that understandably feared them. Anyway, so yeah, those are the four origins. Celestial splits into another four sub-origins, which we call choirs. And then it is a system that does not use classes or does not restrict you to archetypes. So in terms of the skills you have to bear and the attributes you have to bear, that is done in a way that doesn't involve being restricted to classes.
Perfect. So, let's focus on Celestials. Now, I know there are four of them, but Celestials at their base. Could you kind of unpack what a Celestial is? How they live, how they die, how they're different from normal character options?
So, like, we very, very, like, very tongue planted firmly in cheek. We refer to them sometimes as space elves, but that's pretty unfair to Celestials. Basically, the idea is that by torturing all of the humans on board in cryosleep really, really hard, the Gaia found out about this force that no human scientist had ever discovered, or at least no human legitimate scientist with credentials had ever discovered, called the ether, that basically could be squeezed like juice out of humans in cryosleep just by giving them, you know, really, really bad nightmares. And in some way that no one really understands, the Gaia mixed this nightmare juice, the ether, with nanotechnology to create its Celestials. And let's say you really, really for real kill one of those Celestials. Like you were down to the last clone, because as I think we discussed on the intro, there's clones in this game.
Yes, there are backups. There are extra lives.
Yeah, so you're down to the last life, and then, you know, you put five interface, and then just to be sure, you throw an EMP grenade at the body, right, to try and kill the nanites.
Mm-hmm.
Now, somehow, that Celestial as an identity and a character has been killed, but a Celestial, almost like in a kind of science sense, can neither truly be created nor destroyed. So the essence, the soul of the Celestial, whatever you call it, migrates elsewhere and becomes another Celestial of that choir. And occasionally they have, like, flashbacks from their previous lives.
Cool. All right.
And this can happen even if all the nanites are explicitly destroyed, like in
right.
the example. Yep. So it has to do with that ether shit. Yeah.
All right. So... All right, well, then let's move on from Celestials then, seeing as we kind of got a nice groundwork on how they are, to the Replicants.
So here's your big beef with people if you're a Replicant, is that legally you're property almost everywhere except for the places you aren't. You know, like kind of being a black man in the South just shortly before the Civil War. Like, you could cross a border, and now you're property, now you're person, now you're property, now you're person, depending on what state you're in, because
mm-hmm.
of the progress of abolition. So anyway, most of the time, you're property, not a person. And then the other problem is that they intentionally decided to make you sapient. So replicants very legitimately have an axe to grind with humanity, and some of them go rogue. The game's default assumption is that a PC replicant has gone rogue and become a free replicant.
They've gone all Roy Batty?
They don't have to go full Roy Batty by any means. They can just keep off the radar or whatever. But the point is, they have decided consciously to stop being a slave. And they're not programmed to do that, so people are still figuring out, still trying to figure out why that's even possible. Mm-hmm. But there are certainly bounties on them. There are certainly, without going a full Rutger Hauer, there are certainly people looking to retire them and so on. Yeah.
All right, perfect. All right, and I guess that just leaves then the Zell.
So the Zell are so... See, they less have a legitimate axe to grind with humanity and more have a legitimate axe to grind with the Gaia. Because, like, whatever part of the Gaia stored wherever it kidnapped them from did not survive the first and second Exodus. So you've basically got the Zell just stranded, assimilated into human civilization, and they literally have no idea what planet they're from. They have lost all navigational data to it.
Dick move.
They have an NGO called the Zionists, which basically is devoted to, like, getting X amount of government funds dedicated towards finding Zion, X-I-O-N, which is the name of the Zell homeworld.
Right.
And the other thing about the Zell is that, as I wrote recently in a story that I'm going to put up pretty soon after this Kickstarter launches, while by no means are all Zell psionic, you would be an idiot not to assume all Zell are psionic until proven otherwise.
Very good. So they are they more commonly psionic than other characters in the setting?
Is they that get it for hat? They get it for free as part of their origin.
There we go.
Yeah.
All right, and of course, beyond the Zell, the last option is human, and I think enough listeners know the conventions of tabletop RPGs to know what human option is like.
Human option in our game is a little different, but that has to do with how being fueled by suck in our game is a little different. Do you understand the concept of fueled by suck?
A little bit.
Okay, so basically in a lot of games, the one that I'm most familiar with is Hero System, a.k.a. Champions.
Right.
Who I'm up against today, directly up against. They already Steve Long, who is my literal hero, has already launched a Kickstarter today.
Oh, God, right.
Anyway, no. In Champions, you take a lot of disadvantages, physical limitations, psychological limitations, social limitations, whatever, and they give you like 150 points between them that you then get to spend on making your character awesome. And in Fate, you've got aspects, which are kind of like a double-edged sword. They can either be used against you, or you can invoke them to help you kick ass.
Yeah.
And our game handles all that shit a little bit differently, I think, than anything else that's been published. Disclaimer, I have not read literally every RPG that's been published, but not for lack of trying.
Oh, you'll always get that. What you'll always get those one or two people that just need to feel to correct the generalization.
Yeah. So anyway, basically, humans get a free edge, and that's not like a Shadowrun edge. That's like a big deal. They get a point of awesome, and this is a system where you can build your character on up to, I think, off the top of my head, 7 points of awesome. And every point of awesome you get is for giving up something you want, something you actually want. So humans get a point of awesome, which in our game is called an edge, for free. So that actually, while it's not totally inconsistent with your default basic humans in science fiction, it is an interesting way of handling it, because it's sort of that turned up to 11, because a free edge is very substantial.
Okay, well, just to give the listeners kind of maybe a general of idea what edge is used for, because it sounds like it might be permission for different character types. Could you unpack edge for us?
Totally. Let me start with how you build your edge, because you build your edge, you list your edges before you build your character. And this is all stuff I've written in the last few days.
Fresh in your mind then, right?
It's both very fresh in my mind and slightly feverish. This is very important to me because you're a video gamer, right, also?
Yes.
All right, it's very important to me that you understand, that everyone, all listeners understand, that the game we are kickstarting is a standalone game and is fully backwards compatible with the Singularity system. Both of these things are true.
Very cool to know.
So anyway, so you get one free edge if you are a human. You can take up to two problems, from or zero. You get one edge for each problem you take. You can have up to two secret allegiances, one of which is marked as true. Each secret allegiance you take, besides your public faction, you get an edge for. And then finally, every character starts with three extra lives, and you can get an edge for every extra life you sell back.
Oh, shit.
So you can literally do everything from, like, being the most conservative, timid character ever, and just being like a human who just has their one starting edge to make their character awesome, or you can literally go the full retard, so to speak. You can go hard as a motherfucker, and you can be a human that sells back all of their clones, takes two problems, and takes two secret factions, and then you have eight edges to spend.
All right.
And obviously everything in between.
Of course.
Yeah.
So, what are these edges used to build?
All right. Have you ever played any Shadowrun? It's not necessary at all.
Oh, yeah. I've gone through, I think, 4th, 5th, and 3rd here and there.
All right. They're like a way... I wrote a little bit of Shadowrun 5th edition. I might have mentioned...
I think we'll get into that a little bit.
Okay. Anyway, I'm not going to say any dirty things about it. But anyway, they're kind of like a cooler version of the priority system, if you remember.
Ah, yes. Everybody remembers the priority system. It's the first thing you spend like 3 hours figuring out.
Yeah, this is, to me, a much more intuitive way of doing it. So, for instance, I'll just throw off some for instances. Because a character can have at most eight edges, and you are assumed to have less because you are assumed to not have gone full retard, so to speak. An edge can give you extra attributes to build your character on. Characters are usually built on 48 skill points. If you allocate an edge to skills, you get 60. You can spend an edge to start with a starting vehicle. You can spend an edge to be psionic, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
You can spend an edge... Okay, so... Ordinarily, characters have 100,000 free credits worth of cyberware to put in their bodies. You can spend an edge on augmentation to get another 100,000 credits of cyberware to put inside your body. Normally, you have 10,000 credits worth of starting gear. You can spend an edge for 20,000 extra credits worth of starting gear, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So generally speaking, they are... they make your character awesome. They make your character, fictively speaking, a protagonist.
All right, perfect. So, human's hat or special trick seems to be they start with more. They get more oomph to them at the get-go.
They are automatically special in at least one way, yeah.
All right, so that is the, what was that, four character types? The Celestials, the Zell, Humanity, and the Replicants. So, how would you... I don't know, probably, how would you define each one of the four character options for what people would usually play? Like, you know, where do Celestials shine as? Where do humans shine as? Replicants, Zell, that sort of thing.
So it's hard to talk about this without getting a little into the LARP, because the LARP was totally a class-based system.
Oh, okay.
And there were totally five classes. Only four of which I can talk about right now, because like a fourth class is like a whole secret stretch goal kind of thing. Or a fifth class. So for the five classes, from the very first days of the LARP till its very last days, were the samurai, or street samurai, the gunslinger, the hacker, and the psionicist. And one thing I'm proud of is that you can build any of those four archetypes with any of those four origins and still be legitimately effective as a character.
Cool.
But that said, replicants are pretty amazing at everything because they're the Terminator. That kind of is balanced by the downside of being property.
Right.
Celestials are pretty great at most of those things other than being a psionicist. But that comes with the downside of the fact that a strong electromagnetic pulse can murder them without a drop of blood. And that no one trusts them and that they're really, really pretty, which is actually a downside because it means you draw a shit ton of attention in anything resembling a public space. Of course they're pretty. They're genetically perfect. Zell psionicists are very powerful. They have a lot of synergy, to put it mildly, historically. And humans have equal potential in all iterations of the game, including the one I'm currently kicking, have equal potential to excel at anything.
Okay. All right. Perfect. That's a nice little bit of insight. So, with the kind of starting origins for your characters put out there, So when you get down to play systems malfunction, what sort of factions and societies are there to interact with?
Okay, so the cool thing is that... So when did you say that this is actually airing, by the way? You can leave this in or not. I'm just curious.
Oh, yeah, that's fine. This will be on the 27th. So not this Thursday, but next Thursday.
Oh, so by then I will know if I'm, like... By then I will know the course of the battle, certainly.
Right? So 9 days.
Because the next, like I'm super focused on the next 48 hours, by the way.
Oh, I bet.
Because Kickstarters are weird. They are not a bell curve at all. But, like, now remind me what the question was.
Damn it, Devin. What kind of factions and societies and organizations exist in systems malfunction for players to kind of bounce off of?
So the first thing, to remind you of is that, remember, you can have two secret factions and then you can get an edge for each secret faction you take,
right?
And that only one of them can be for reals. That said, so basically we're writing this anthology about a bunch of terrorists affiliated with the Fallen who want to see all of society go the fuck down.
Yes, the Luddites. You mentioned them.
It's a corrupt system ruled by a succession of presidents for life that oppresses all of its citizens that aren't pure humans, and it needs to burn down. So we're writing this whole anthology about them, but, like, equally valid is the party could be Republic Intelligence Agency agents trying to catch those terrorists. Like, that's equally valid. The important thing is that you all have several secret allegiances. I guess I'd also like to give a shout out besides the Fallen and the Republic. And by the way, there are like a myriad, almost like one of those Russian nesting dolls. There are a myriad of secret spoiler factions and systems.
I imagine so.
But just talking about the most surface level ones, you've got the Fallen, the various branches of the Republic, which don't always get along. And much like the real life U.S. military, which it's very much explicitly modeled on. And then you've got the three great houses. Great House Dresden, no relation to the fictional character Harry Dresden, the city in Europe.
Right.
Sorry, that's just almost every time I tell someone.
Really?
For 10 years. Oh, yeah. The Dresden Files are crazy popular. I have yet to read them. Great House Yamamoto and Great House Dallas. And earlier I talked about how the lottery was totally rigged on who got off Earth. And this is the end result of that, is that these three great houses have emerged with very different cultures, each controlling their own solar system or several.
All right. So it looks like there's a lot of government organizations, small splinter factions, secret factions, great houses a la MechWarrior or what's the other one with great houses other than Game of Thrones?
The one that I learned that Dune is probably
Dune. That's it.
The one I learned it from actually wasn't Space Kablooey at all. I learned it from the Elder Scrolls series. Actually.
Ah, yes.
That's where I first encountered the idea of great houses. But then I encountered it in Dune, and then I realized that it was just totally a real thing historically, and still is.
Right.
Like DuPonts, Rockefellers, Rothschilds. Anyway, go on.
All right. So, now that we got kind of that groundwork done, what is happening in Systems Malfunction, the Kickstarter? Remember, this will be 9 days into your Kickstarter right now, so anything up to those 9 days that you want to reveal, please let the listeners know. What do they have to expect from the different tiers or surprises around the corner, or maybe even stretch goals on the horizon?
All right, it's really hard to say. What I really hope is that by the time you're hearing this... Oh, gosh, this is terrible because I have to be my own Cassandra. I have to kind of make a prediction, sort of, and then see how far short of the mark. My dearest hope is that if you hear this 9 days from now, on the 27th, we will have at least reached our full color stretch goal, which will let us do the book in full color. And before we hit that, we have to put motherfucking vampires. Yes, that's right, vampires, but you already know about those.
Oh, listeners know.
Listeners know. Okay. If Verkalax, I should say Verkalax, not vampires. We will put Verkalax into the game. Ethereal Magic will be in the game. Something by someone famous will be in the game as fiction, like legitimately famous. Not like me. I'm fake famous. And then also in the game will be Starship Combat proper, including deck plans. So we've got all those things leading up to full color, and I sure hope 9 days from now we've got full color at 20 grand.
That doesn't seem that far off the mark. Looking at previous Kickstarters, listeners, the Psyonix, which was... That wasn't your most recent, but that was certainly one of the more popular ones. It got stacked.
It was our first and our most successful, and it funded at 500%, and we were just like so... We were literally astonished and grateful.
Yeah.
Like, we totally didn't have to fake it. Like, those people at various companies keep doing after, like, Kickstarters they knew would make several million dollars, And they have to be like, oh my god, we're so surprised that we funded.
How did this happen that we just outsourced?
We were legitimately astonished and grateful. We were like, what? Because it funded almost overnight, and then it went to fund at five times what we asked.
Yeah, it's amazing. For reference, maybe just let listeners know, Psyonix was going for $2,500, and by the end of it all...
No, $2,000, I believe. Maybe you could be right. I could be wrong. I'm very tired.
$2,500, it says here, Nicole. I have the page up. I got a little couple research tabs.
All right, so we only did 400% then. Yeah.
Yeah, at $10,500.
Nice, yes.
Which is amazing.
That was little pledges, mostly, from a ton of backers, but we did have some awesome super backers, too, who we met over that campaign.
Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of it lived at the PDF copy.
I should definitely talk about this. This will still be relevant on the 9th, probably, unless they all sell out before then. You can actually get yourself in the game in the art, and then if you pledge even more generously, you can get yourself in the game in the fiction.
That's fun. I always love those little touches that are in the backer rewards where you can kind of assert yourself.
We did that with Psyonix, and we are doing it better now, having learned lessons.
You know, speaking about that, what lessons did you learn from that? Because I've always wondered how that works from your end. How does the process go from someone pledging to have their character inserted into art or fiction, and how is it handled from the back end?
Well, let me start with it. First off, we got people... So, all right, I don't want to, like, throw shade on our backers. They were amazing. But basically, like, first off, we offered it at a ludicrously low amount. That's one thing we did. Another thing we did is that we just made the nonsense assumption that a book that is full color will cost twice as much as one that's black and white inside because that turned out to be completely wrong. And our approach of asking literally no one was not a good one. Because the actual truth is that a book that is full color costs at least four times as much.
Jesus.
As one that's black and white inside because, other Devin, you have to pay double for the art and double for the printing.
Oh, no.
So anyway, that's fine. Basically, the biggest learn on that was that, like, just because people have given you money to be in your game doesn't mean that they will talk to you, at least in anything resembling a reasonable time frame.
I have heard this.
We definitely had to make some shit up. One of my favorite backer characters is a character named Sand. Who I've done a lot I really like with in the Psyonix universe and who will be appearing in future Psyonix products. The only reason his name is Sand is because I think that was the name of the backer. We couldn't get a character name out of the guy. I think we got basically a tweet's worth of description and then he just disappeared. But the character has become awesome and is in so much art and like fiction.
That's amazing. That is a thing I have heard and that listeners should keep in mind. To just cut to another Kickstarter we were recently talking about, Kevin Crawford's Godbound. That finished up like almost a year ago now, like 6, 7, 8 months, and the backer books have already been delivered. Except for like one or two people who just disappeared off the face of the earth and never gave him the info.
Right. Yeah, that's another thing. So, that's another thing. And then we've had people move from like normal places to sorry, that was probably excessive shade throwing on Australia.
Oh man. The land of poison and spiders.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's the thing for listeners. When you back a Kickstarter and you get those kinds of rewards or pledges, you gotta keep in contact, because the sooner you get those details to the Kickstarter, the better, especially for things like getting art commissioned and whatnot.
Yeah, I know. No, we've really given ourselves plenty of room, because we're not. First off, we've never missed it. We're one of the very few creators on Kickstarter that can say we've never really missed a deadline. Like,
it's a good position to be in.
In terms of the primary product we were trying to deliver, like, you can point to a lot of creators considered successful who are on paper successful financially that have literally never delivered on time.
Right.
No, because that's part of why I was initially so stubborn about doing Kickstarter. That and the fact that I'm whatever the opposite of an early adopter is. I was like, no, I'm just going to burn my own money forever.
Yeah.
No, it's we have left ourselves plenty of time to work with backers. We're really excited to see backers at the Cerebrit tier, where we get to insert you into the fiction as well as the art. That should be awesome. It's always helpful to generate ideas for our artists to draw stuff. I don't know if you've seen the Kickstarter preview.
I have it up right now. Actually, I was going to mention the Cerebrit tier is $200 or more.
Yeah, but I mean, are you seeing that art is what I was mainly asking, because we finally gotten it up and we're so happy with it.
Yeah, it looks really good. I like the picture that shows up in the video.
Yeah.
With the gunships.
Oh, yeah. If you're talking about the piece called Outgunned, Outmanned, that's a convention scenario I wrote called the Burning Wings, that happens during an all-out attack by the Fallen on Avalon. That I really want to work with Ron Edwards on some fiction and or adventures.
We should definitely talk a little bit more about this Ron Edwards character as we come closer.
Oh, Ron Edwards is the father of story games and the story gaming movement, although he has, for understandable reasons, he's distanced himself from elements of that scene.
Could you define to our listeners what the story game and the story game movement are? It can be described in shockingly different ways depending on where you hear it from.
I'm just going to describe it the way Ron Edwards would describe it, but like shorter.
Perfect.
Because I have to go watch my Kickstarter launch like a fucking rocket in about an hour.
Right.
Hopefully a rocket and not a rocket disaster, which is also possible.
Not the first few SpaceX rockets, the last few.
SpaceX is you're too young for me. Right. I was thinking of the Challengers and I couldn't think of which ones. Hopefully none of us will die, I guess. But narrativism, Ron Edwards says, is story now. If the first thing you want a role-playing game to do is to tell a story collaboratively and your table agrees, then you want a story game. And a story game that delivers successfully what it's delivering is story now.
Okay. What would be some examples for listeners, just off the top of your head? What are some examples story games out there in the wild that are closest to Ron's vision?
I think that Dogs in the Vineyard probably was a good example.
Oh, shit. I own that book.
By D. Vincent Baker. I think, in general, D. Vincent Baker is pretty important. His importance is, like, kind of difficult to overstate. All in all. Other story games in the wild off the top of my head. I don't know. It's very arguable. It becomes very arguable very quickly.
Yeah, I found that.
Story games are related to narrativism, which is one of the central drives for gaming that Ron Edwards... It's fair enough to say he literally laments giving names to them. But narrativism is the driving motivation behind, say, Fate by Fred Hicks.
Oh, okay, yeah.
People hack games. But then again, there are, I mean, and I'm trying to mention story games that I like. I'm trying to think of story games that I like. It's not my specific style of gaming, but this is important. It is an agenda that I think Systems Malfunction supports, or I would never have gone through the time and trouble of getting Ron Edwards involved.
Okay, well, that's perfect as a kind of a little crash course on it. People can kind of look into that on their own. So tell us about Ron Edwards' involvement.
So basically, he's with us for the whole campaign, which starts today, so I don't know that much about it yet. He's offered some very good incisive criticism so far, and I won't know more until we're further into the campaign, but he's, like, one of my writers asked me recently permission to contact my other writers, which wasn't the thing he needed to ask me for. But I basically said, yeah, sure, but not Ron Edwards. And his literal response was like, it didn't occur to me to try to contact Ron Edwards any more than it would have occurred to me to try to contact Odin or Zeus. And I was like, all right, I guess I was not underestimating Ron Edwards' importance to the tabletop role-playing game hobby.
Oh my God.
But yeah, no, that was his response to me suggesting that no, it wasn't okay for him to talk to Ron.
That's amazing.
And I'm sure after hearing this, and I'm pretty sure Ron will hear this, he'll probably talk to Rich K. So that's the other end of it. But all right, so what else we got?
The Ron Edwards connection you were saying was a big deal that you wanted to kind of bring in for this. So if you have any more thoughts on that, please feel free.
I don't know. He's going to be with us for a month starting today. And, you know, every day of, you know, in D&D, it's called a campaign. And D&D evolved from Chainmail, right? Which was a war game. And a Kickstarter crowdfunding platform, when you run on it for X amount of time, that is called a campaign. Like in war. So Ron Edwards is like a general. Just, it's vaguely like having Odin or Zeus as your general. It's pretty sweet.
It is pretty cool for him to come out of the sort of retirement he was in to help guide the Kickstarter you're running. That seems like a pretty cool thing.
And I will say that the power... Okay, so one last thing on story games before we move on.
Sure.
I will say that the power... This was also had Ron's consultation and approval. And the Powered by the Apocalypse series, or the Powered by the Apocalypse system, Apocalypse World, Dungeon World, et al., was a very popular series of story games.
Oh, okay. Yes, those as well. I remember hearing about those. Perfect. All right. So we've talked about the Kickstarter, a bit of systems malfunction, a very action-oriented sci-fi setting. Let's talk a bit about you as a developer, as an RPG guy. Tell us a bit where you got your start. Just to front load this for the audience or for listeners, Devin Oratz has been a writer for Shadowrun.
I've written hundreds of thousands of words for Shadowrun 4th edition and 5th edition. But I did that all in a relatively short period of time because I write very swiftly. That said, are you asking how I got my start in the industry? Because that's easy.
Sure.
Okay, it was 2011, and it was February, and two things happened simultaneously. The first thing that happened is that Ron Edwards held, like, one of the very last design a whole RPG in 24 hours contests on the Forge.
I kind of remember those.
And at that point, yeah, see, I was a latecomer to the Forge. I came to the Forge in what Ron called the winter of the Forge. Ron is really good at using ominous terminology to describe, like, basic, straightforward things. Like, for instance, the consultation service that I'm grateful to have purchased from him is called Scorched by the Gaze of Adept Press. Anyway, so I came to the Forge during the winter of the Forge. And I wrote a game in 24 hours while listening to a lot of really excessively goth and emo music called Anathema. And I didn't even get, like, the whole story game thing then, really. So I didn't really realize what was meant by write a game in 24 hours. I thought that they meant, like, write, like, a game in 24 hours. Like, Exalted or whatever.
Yeah.
So I did. Like, and it was called Anathema, and it only came out to 20 pages, but it was, like, very much, like, it was a full-on RPG. It was definitely, like, it was a role-playing game. And it's basically its core concept. You still with me?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Cool. Its core concept is the Earth is terribly overpopulated. If it remains as overpopulated as it is, everyone will die. So you died. You don't remember how you died. You're back. You're an angel of death. You have almost omnipotent powers. Decrease the surplus population by any means necessary. So basically, Ron Edwards saw that and he was like, "This is pretty cool. Here's $50," which is sort of a I won a Ronnie Award. Whatever. Anyway, that is what they're technically
whatever
called.
You know, no big deal.
It is no big deal because there were several winners that month, so it is no big deal.
But more importantly, there were even more losers.
There were a few people that didn't win. Ron would never call anyone a loser. No, it's I came from the same set of prompts that produced Elizabeth Sampitz. I can't remember. Anyway, those prompts that Ron, because he would just throw three words at you, and then he would just be like, "You got 24 hours to make a game. Go." And I was like, "Whatever. I'm 25. I can fucking do this." And I just like 24 hours of just writing a game about killing the entire world as an angel of death, listening to most goth emo shit I possibly can. And then afterwards, I just felt so dirty when the game was finally out of me. I was like, I need to wash my brain with Disney cartoons.
That's awesome.
Anyway, so in the same month, I had stopped being too much of a wussy to submit some stuff on spec to Catalyst Game Labs, who published Shadowrun.
Right.
And they saw what I published, or they saw what I submitted on spec, and they were like, "Yeah, we can't use that because there's a bunch of meta plot we wrote in secret that you don't know about." Because, you know, that's how it works.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you can write stuff. And I was like, oh, my God. Because Shadowrun has been the single thing that has been my primary fandom for pretty much my entire life. And people who get deep into the system on Kickstarter will immediately see my, like, my bleeding Shadowrun all over it, so to speak. I wrote for them for about 5 years. I have credits in most of the Shadowrun books that came out between, I want to say around, that came out in the period of 2012 to, or 2011 to 2013. Then I took a little break for a while. Then I got a story at a fiction anthology this year. I have a story called Jodo, which is the Orzhet word for honor. Orzhet is the orc language in Shadowrun. I'm a nerd.
Oh, man, anyway. Orc language and Shadowrun, the stories.
Hold on, though, but Mike Stackpole, if we want to talk about kind of a big deal, Mike Stackpole leads off the anthology, then I get to fucking bat number two. So that's not bad.
That's pretty good.
As far as your fiction name drops go. I am sort of quits with them now. Had been semi-quits with them before the anthology thing. Running your own game company takes a lot of time and energy, possibly more than I have to begin with. So I am still open to freelancing, though, in the industry, definitely.
All right. So, and that was kind of the core, your core experience. You went from kind of doing your own sort of thing, submitting to Catalyst Labs, and from there just writing for Shadowrun. That's kind of the arc?
So early, like in 2011, I was also working very briefly for Secret Fire Games, but that did not end amicably. Which is to say that George Strayton said that he would pay me better than WotC and as many words as I wanted if I wrote basically his entire monster manual for him overnight. So I did, like an idiot. And then my response was basically being told to fuck off. And as far as I can tell, that is still George Strayton's position, because I have not heard from him since then.
My God.
So I feel a little taken advantage of there. A little. I think that won an award or something, but I don't think it's an actively supported game anymore.
Just checked the website as we were talking, and it has not been updated for 3 or 4 years. Oh, and there's a review up on Fatal and Friends. That's never a good sign.
Yeah. Oh. Interesting.
Oh, actually, speaking of contradictory statements, Psionics is on Fatal and Friends. Someone did a minor review of it. It looks pretty good.
Oh, I've heard from John from John Jamat, who's our director of marketing, sales, and logistics, and who's also literally like a human reward tier for this Kickstarter, which he's very excited about. as a mad scientist, his time is, like, I've heard of Kickstarters have had human stretch goals before, but he's a human reward tier, damn it. They're up to four groups that can have him as just their GMing bitch for systems malfunction if they pledge high enough. So I hope somebody springs for that. Anyway, what was I saying about John? What was I going to say about John? What were we talking about?
I told what you about we... the Fatal and Friends review up on Psyop.
Oh, Sionics. No. I think he's read the Sionics review, and I think it's overwhelmingly positive. If it's the
yeah,
same
it's pretty there. Positive. It goes through. It gives you a nice breakdown of everything. It's an excellent way to kind of get a handle on a game if you're not that aware of it.
Do all your listeners already know what Fatal is and that it's bad?
I'm sure they'll get it from context if they look up Fatal Tabletop RPG Review in Google. They'll get
that's
the gist.
Really, I think the single moment that I most pissed off RPG.net... Never mind.
No,
it's a bad idea to finish.
I'll bring
that
you
sentence.
Back for a shit talk conversation. It'll be great.
You need to. You can't bring just me though. You need to find like other angry people. Like get Grimachu.
Oh my Christ! Oh, I have him on my Twitter.
Gonna,
he just goes, man.
He's gonna. I'm gonna outsource a lot of my layout shit to him. Coming.
Oh, cool. So, could you could you tell the listeners who Grimachu is? Like, I know who he is, but tell the listeners.
He's James Desbro. He made a card game called Gamergate. But he's been, like, in the industry since forever, like, since the start of the D20 boom. Your listeners know what Fatal is. Speaking of Fatal and Friends, Fatal is a very bad game. and
right?
If you think it's not, then you should feel bad, just to anyone listening, for the record. I have a standing offer out to freelance, besides running my own company, which does keep me plenty busy. Which is that I have submitted an email to Kevin Symbieta, owner of Palladium Books.
Oh, no, Uncle Kevin.
To Uncle Kevin to freelance for Rifts for pretty much whatever he feels like paying me. Because I like the setting of Rifts a lot.
Everyone likes the setting of Rifts.
I like the setting of Rifts more than that. I feel like the setting of Rifts is my spirit animal. I can't explain it.
It resonates with that kind of...
I have Uncle Kevin's phone number, and I should call him after this Kickstarter is done. And be like, dog. So, I mean, no, I would never say that to Kevin Zubieta. I'd be like, sir, please let me write for you.
Oh, my God.
I want it. Like, I'm
no,
not,
definitely.
Like, I'm not dying to freelance. Like, I got an offer from, like, FOSSA, and I was pretty excited. I learned a lot of the material,
oh, wow.
And
like,
I found
like
out...
FOSSA?
The resurrected FOSSA.
Ah, okay.
So I was like pretty excited. I did a lot of the research, and then finally, like after about 2 weeks of research, I was like, I had my writing gloves on. I was ready to go, and they told me what it paid, and it was just like, I can't justify working for that.
Right.
Not even for FOSSA. And the dude was like, that's all right. Like this writer. Doesn't even get out of bed unless he gets this much, and that was like way more than I wanted them to pay me. So it's I don't know, it's a big pond. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, in that case, then let's bring it back a bit to the Kickstarter. So here we are.
Hopefully, it's a fucking boulder being pulled into that pond, but that's gonna make a big splash. I hope if it isn't devoured by the vortex of what's it called? What's the It was Laser Kittens, and now what's the new one?
It was like Cats versus Babies or something. I didn't pay attention to it.
Cats versus Babies. It's just such an automatic mimetic cash in. I really like the oatmeal for the record.
Oh yeah,
like,
yeah, it's fine. It's just I've never played their card games. I have no interest.
It's just like seeing someone fire like a very advanced energy weapon that tears a vortex in reality that an infinite amount of money will flow through.
Yes, that's exactly what will happen. Well, it scratches that itch. The oatmeal is read by, you know, dozens of thousands of millions of people who have Facebook. So they're like, oh, yeah, I want an oatmeal thing. It's like the Chive.
Yeah.
Dating someone right there.
Yeah.
So it's understandable that would kind of hit every demographic when it comes out.
Yes.
So, yeah, any predictions for the
Kickstarter? I have Exploding Kittens. I haven't played it yet, but I own Exploding Kittens.
Yeah. So, any predictions for the Kickstarter? Any sort of...
Certainly no predictions. One does not make predictions within an hour of something's launch. Only prayers at this point. We're in the trenches.
40 minutes.
Yeah. What else?
I think that's everything. I think we've covered a good chunk of...
No. You were starting a comma-separated list, and I cut you off at the first word, predictions.
My God. All right, so... Any predictions, thoughts, maybe even comments about how to run a Kickstarter to any of the listeners out there who are just ready to make the jump but are a little bit scared?
All right, first off, so Kickstarter is where you will build a fan base. That's crucial.
Right.
If it's something you want to create, go to bring it to Kickstarter and get noticed. I don't promise that Psyonix got noticed because it deserves to, but we did put a hell of a lot of work into it, and it got noticed. That would be my general advice to creators, is that you're already late to the Kickstarter party. Go there now before the party is over.
Before the bubble bursts.
And other than that, to anyone hearing this that has not checked out our Kickstarter, please check out our Kickstarter, because we have put all of the awesome in the galaxy there. And you will get to see all of the ends of all of the worlds.
I think I'll put up a text post on the podcast tonight when it's live, just so people can see the link. But
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah. So, any one last thing. Any definite setbacks or things that a new Kickstarter runner should avoid from your experience? Like, what would be the biggest thing?
Physical products that aren't the main book.
Little widgets and stuff? Statues and shit?
Dice, t-shirts. Oh, God, t-shirts. Oh, God, t-shirts. Don't. Yeah, you know what? If I could just reduce to two words, don't t-shirts.
There you go.
Unless the Kickstarter is for a t-shirt. And I think I've literally never seen a Kickstarter for a t-shirt. So
Fan Gamer Retrowear. Their entire Kickstarter was t-shirts and hoodies.
Great. Wasn't aware of that. That's cool. All right, they're the one exception. Everyone else on the internet, for God's sakes, do not throw in a t-shirt. It will not just work itself out with the shipping and whatever.
So Kickstarter fan base is a yes, t-shirts is a no.
Yes. Yeah, try not to make anything that's a physical thing you have to ship out, except the thing that you're backing in the first place. And Perfect. We've broken that rule a little bit with the Sysmel Kickstarter, but we've broken it because of really cool shit that we probably would have made anyway.
All right, that's perfect. Well, I guess we'll know what's going to be up in a few hours after that post goes up, and listeners will
see. I'm going to go to sleep, and I'm going to wake up tomorrow, and I'm going to feel a feeling.
There you go. Feeling emotions in your heart cage.
One of two different feelings.
There you go. So, I am Devin from Sponsored by Nobody, and today we have our actual sponsor, Devin Oratz from End Transmission Games.
And good night, Canadian Devin.
Good night, American Devin. Thank you for being on our show. Have yourself a good one. And that's us.
You too.
Signing off. Gonna be the future soon. I won't always be this way. When the things that make me weak and strange get engineered away.